John, thank you for coming in, and I'm excited because this is the year of the passenger pigeon.
Well, I'll tell you, Thane, the passenger pigeon has been literally on my mind since the day I knew they had existed, and I only wished at that time. I was born in 1924, and Martha departed in 1914, so I missed her by a few years. But being from Cincinnati, I was always aware of the passenger pigeon.
Now, listeners might not know, but you played a key role for the Cincinnati Zoo 40 years ago, helping really drive the creation of our passenger pigeon memorial. Tell a bit about that.
Oh, I did. I was so thrilled in one respect and horrified in another. I knew the bird had been in the long since gone when I used to go to the zoo as a kid. But then when Ed Ruska came on as director, he called me one day and he said, John, he says, I got some good news, bad news for you. He said, the good news is we're going to build a new apron at the zoo, but the bad news is we're going to have to destroy the old bird run for the new apron. And I said, Ed, you can't do that. I said, Martha died in this one, and so did Incas, the last Carolina parakeet. He said, well, it's too expensive, John. We can't do it. He said, we've checked to see if we could keep one of the buildings, how much it would cost to move it to a new location. Was $50,000 to move it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I had all kinds of money. I said, Ed, what's wrong with that? So he says, well, we can't have the money to do it. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do, Ed. I'll do a special painting to raise the seed money to start it going, which I did. And unbeknownst to us, an anonymous donor came by and not only bought the original, but paid for the total restoration of the building plus the landscaping. So we were off and running.
Well, it was thanks to you, and it remains today an important tribute, which is particularly important now 40 years later because, unfortunately, the last of the species, Martha, who lived in that building, went extinct, died 100 years ago.
Yeah. It's something that happened in the life of mankind that'll never happen again, and it's the first time that we know as mankind that it happened. And one of the billions of pigeons went from that number to nothing. Mm-hmm. And Martha was the last of her kind.
Yeah, once the most numerous bird in North America went to zero. And it seemed almost impossible then, seems almost impossible now.
I know, it does. And there's I'm being involved with this so many times, and I've in your office today, I saw two of my originals, the one that I used to raise the money for.
That's
the,
right.
Then another one, and I'd forgotten about that, but I've done, I think, 10 different paintings of passenger pigeons, including my latest on the side of a building in downtown Cincinnati, 3 stories high and 90 feet long.
And that was last summer, and I saw you up there. It was the hottest 2 weeks in August, which is saying something, and you had to climb up that scaffolding 6 or 7 stories just to do the bird.
Yeah, tell me about it. It was really hot. And I was up there, and I painted in a very detailed manner, as you know. And here I am with a 4-inch wide brush, and I couldn't back up, of course, because I'd be flat on my back in the parking lot below. So it was a challenge to do it, but one that I took with great heart and felt this wonderful empathy towards trying to convey the feeling and the loss of this species.
Mm-hmm. And the original painting is just beautiful. And it's what is the one that's the one on the mural modeled from. And I think you called it Martha, the Last Passenger Pigeon. And it features that famous bird run, those Victorian bird buildings, like the one where we still have at the zoo. And a huge flock. How many birds do you think you have in that flock?
Well, my secretary, Selma, said I started counting them. And she said I ran out of breath. And I said, well, there are a million birds in that. But they boil down to little bitty dots off to the right. And they swirl into this well-known pattern that the passenger pigeon used to fly in, this corkscrew epic flight pattern. And I have, starting with the multitudes in the background, and finally swirling up to Martha, twisting and leading full size on, you know, her leading her minions into oblivion. And it shows several different things in there, not only the pattern and the life of the bird, but these wonderful buildings that were in the one of the first zoos in the country. So it was a great feeling of history there.
You know, that's interesting, John, because many listeners have probably seen a flock of sparrows or, you know, small flock of crows, but the idea of seeing a single flock right there of a million birds was not uncommon 150 years ago.
That's right. And from horizon to horizon. And so many people tried to estimate the number, and it was always in the billions. Mm. And they would fly night and day. The pigeon was a great mover. He was a great traveler. And mainly was after food. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine the amount of seeds and nuts and bugs that it took to feed a billion pigeons continually? And they were in their prime. They existed in the great primeval forests of North America.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know they were shot for sport, shot for food. Obviously, with the advent of technology, it was easier for people to kill them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But having said that, you still wonder about being able to kill a billion birds. So what was going on with that? Was it just sport?
Well, you know, it was a combination of all of it. Joel Greenberg's new pigeon, the river of feathers, and he cites examples continuously about the slaughter of these birds. There was no refrigeration at that time. It had just come in at the demise of the flocks. But telegraph came in at that time. Mm-hmm. The railroads came in at that time. And so the pigeon hunters could get on these trains and go to the big flocks and kill them by the millions. And the squabs were the delicacy. And they were very fat. And when they would knock them out of the nests, and the ones they didn't keep, they would bring their hogs in to feed on them. Mm. And for 40 incessant years, they did this and decimated the flocks. And there were natural occurrences, of course, at that time. Some were caught in tornadoes. Mm-hmm. And there were reports of that from the Chicago area and the Great Lakes. So the continuous persecution finally wiped them out. But no one realized that they could ever be exterminated. Even Audubon said, you know, they're less and less that I see every year, but they'll never exhaust them.
Mm. It's fascinating, and you've lived long enough to see that change, where people at one time thought, whether that's the oceans with seafood or whether it's, game on the land, the idea of, oh, yeah, it's replenished every year, we'll never run out.
Yeah, exactly. And another case in point are the American waterfowl population. Mm-hmm. Before the 1930s, with the initiation of the duck stamp, which raised millions of dollars for habitat, wetlands for ducks, the ducks were in a nosedive to extinction. Mm-hmm. And they were saved totally by that. And so if we can inspire our generations to save the ones that are on the brink now, it'd be a wonderful thing.
And I know one of the early claims to fame you had was doing one of the first duck stamps.
It was.
Yeah. Tell what duck did you put on that?
I put the redhead ducks, a family of them. And this was a 1960-61 duck stamp.
There you go.
And I was just honored to be a part of that situation as well. And I might add one little thing. When I won the stamp, there were countless people who wanted to buy the original, one of whom was a fellow in Chicago named Charles Wacker. I guess Wacker Drive was named after him. But very quickly, I'll go through with this. I had a show in Chicago showing the original, big expose with Abercrombie and Fish, and lo and behold, someone sneaked into the front window and stole the original.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's, to this day, I don't know who has it, but it'll show up someday because they know they've got it. But Charles wanted to buy it, and I told him about this, and he said, well, can you paint me another one? I said, I don't know, but I'll check with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And they said, well, if you just put one more reed, these ducks were swimming through the reed, and that'll be okay. So I did it. So there's two out there. One has one more reed in it.
That is a great story.
And then so he bought that.
Now, of course, famously, you are 89 years old now.
Yeah.
But having said that, your adventures continue. You're not just looking at birds that have been long gone.
Yeah.
Tell what you're up to. You're even still looking for the ivory bill.
Next week, I'm going down to northern Florida along the Choctahatchee River with a group of 10 of us, and we're going to try to find a nesting spot of the ivory-billed woodpecker. It has been seen by one of our group before. John Agnew, a consummate naturalist, wonderful photographer, but he was so transfixed by it that he couldn't take his eyes off, and he didn't photograph
it. Oh, there you go.
And it flew right over his head. And once you know the ivory bill as intimately as he does, you'll never forget it. And he's, to this day, he said, it made my life and ruined my life. He goes, no one believes I saw it, but I did see it.
Well, you know, you hear stories, right? They once had a population in the Southeast, mm-hmm. I guess all the way to the Caribbean in Cuba. But you hear of one not too long ago, there was a sighting, I think, in Arkansas.
Yep.
And then I know there's some professors in Alabama who talk about it. There you are in the panhandle. Even all the way to Cuba, there are sightings. So hopefully there's hope.
Yeah. And incidentally, just last week, as I was mentioning to you coming down, and I got a call from the Cuban State Department saying that I had a visa permission to go into the Sierra Madre Mountains of Cuba with my guide, Cuban guide, and hunt for the ivory-billed woodpecker. Now, here I am, like I say, I'm 89. My mind says, John, what an opportunity, go. But I don't know if the old, the 89-year-old body will do it, because we're going to be trekking four full days through the mountains in the heat of the Cuban summer. So I am still thinking about it.
Yeah, well, I know that if anybody's up to it, you are, and you've done such a tremendous amount. Winner of the National Medal of Arts, naturally famous for doing a lot of work, helping the zoo, as we said, but also even public broadcasting, WCET, WGUC, and the Museum of Natural History here, which is just down the street from these studios. I know you helped build their bird collection.
Oh, absolutely, I did, and I went out every Saturday with the curator of birds at the University of Cincinnati, collecting birds for the collection. And I've skinned out roadside kills. I had a permit to pick up roadside kills, a federal permit. And I skinned those out and painted them, and didn't eat them, though, but all like Audubon did, you know.
Exactly.
He shot them and ate them and painted them. So, but anyway, it's been a life of excitement in this regard. And I welcome every opportunity to paint these birds. I'm still painting like crazy.
Oh, I know. And everyone's excited that you'll give a talk soon at the zoo our celebration of the anniversary of Martha, the last passenger.
Yeah, visitor. It's going to be an exciting moment, Thane, and to be with you and all the rest of the zoo people, because you all do a spectacular job. And I can't say enough from my standpoint.
Well, John, thank you. You're a good friend and certainly a great naturalist from our region, and carried on a great tradition, as you said, from Audubon all the way through. So thanks to you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you today, Thane, and thank you.
You bet. My guest has been wildlife painter and naturalist John Ruthven. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.